All right, we're recording. The screen is shared. Y'all can see my PowerPoint screen? Everybody see my screen okay? Can I get like a yes, unmuted, or a thumbs up or something? Good deal. All right, my friends, as I mentioned, live lecture three today, chapter three of the textbook on philosophical foundations in health education and promotion. I know the word philosophy can sort of make your stomach churn. I think when I was an undergrad my freshman year at IU, that's where I started my undergrad career, I remember taking an intro to philosophy class my freshman year. And it was not my favorite class, sort of serendipitous that I ended up becoming a PhD and my actual degree is a doctor of philosophy. But I hope today to remove some of the negativity and the shroud of philosophy for you, especially as it comes to impact how you think about health and health education and promotion. So that's where we're going to be going for the course of our time together today. So some important announcements on the front end. First and foremost, I want to mention that I will be posting, it says here that I have posted it, but I'm actually finishing it as we speak, well, not as we speak, today. A narrated presentation relative to your next assignment, per se. Your resume and career character skills has a long title. We'll just call it the character assessment assignment. That assignment is actually the first one that you're going to legitimately turn into me this semester. So we've already talked about professional development in one of those presentations. But that's an assignment you work on all semester and turn in at the very end. These assignments, the resume and character paper, are assignments that you will actually turn in relatively soon, in my opinion. They're the first, at the end of October. So I'm in the process, about halfway through, of narrating some slides relative to that assignment that I'll be posting in the assignment description folder that sort of walk you through all of the nuts and bolts and everything you need to know about the resume assignment and the character skills assignment. If you go into our modules on our Canvas page and then scroll down to the assignment descriptions module and then look for the assignment presentations little sub tab, that's where I'll be posting all of the narrated presentations about specific assignments. So while it's not imperative that you listen to that this week, I would encourage you definitely sometime next week at the latest to listen to that presentation. Both of these assignments are assignments that are very hard to complete successfully quickly. Especially the resume assignment, which takes a lot of work in drafting and editing, and you're going to be submitting it to software and et cetera. It just takes a while. So I would definitely think about giving that presentation a listen to. But as I mentioned, the assignments themselves aren't due until I think October 25th. So you have a little time, but nonetheless, something to keep in mind. We will have a guest speaker video posted next week. Really, I think the second of the semester, we had Kara from the Student Voluntary Services video interview with her. And next week, I'm going to be chatting with Dylan Wagner, who I think I've referenced in multiple assignment announcements and things this semester. Dylan's an important person you should get to know. He is our College of Health Career Center representative. So at the Career Center at Ball State, which is sort of your clearinghouse for all things relative to career and professional preparation, resumes, finding potential job postings to apply to, getting an internship, all of those things. They have specific representatives who are connected to each of the colleges across campus. And Dylan is our College of Health Career Center representative. So when it comes to knowing where students to go in terms of career paths in the College of Health and how to prepare them for that, Dylan is the person to get to know. And he's a very conversational, fun person just to sit down and chat with. Dylan and I will be chatting next week relative to two assignments, really. He's going to be talking for a while about resume development. He's going to talk about ins and outs, tips, what to think about when putting together a resume. He's going to talk to you about how to submit your resume to a system called VMOC, which is going to be part of the resume assignment. So he's going to walk you through that. And then he's also going to talk to you about how to find an informant for your informational interview assignment, which is another one we won't talk about yet, but in long-range planning will be coming up not too far in the future. So Dylan will be speaking with us. I'll be posting that video next week, and I would definitely give that a listen to. And of course, if you have more information that you need, he's very accessible by email. Moving forward, I wanted to remind you today, moving forward, that your slides will have holes in them. If you've downloaded the PowerPoint slides to accompany today's lecture, you'll notice that not all the content is there. Usually I put a few dots or a space to let you know there's something missing. I don't do that to punish you. You're already here and you're getting points for your attendance, but sort of as a way to keep you engaged and taking good notes while you're here, because I know it's got to be hard for you sitting at home to stay invested for an hour and 15 and listening to me lecture. So Moving forward, your slides will have some holes in them and you'll just want to make sure you're paying good attention. Last but not least, continue to communicate with me, ask me questions regarding professional development. I address multiple questions almost every week from students who want some help in finding a good volunteer location or want to know if something counts as a location, how to get proof for something. So never feel like you're burdening me by sending me an email or wanting to set up a time using FaceTime or using Zoom or WebEx or whatever tool that might be best for you to talk about professional development. I'm always here to help you with that. Okay. Any questions about the items that you see on this screen currently? All right, I don't see anything popping up with my chat bar, so we'll keep on chugging. So probably what's more likely on your mind, I would guess, which is your first course exam, which is set to take place next week. Wow, it's really strange to think that we're already there, but I guess now that we're week four, almost week five of the semester, I guess it does make sense that it's about time for an exam. I'm going to start with some sort of basic information about your exam that I think most of you probably want to know, and then give you some hints and tips relative to studying and preparing that I think will be very useful for those of you who are listening to me today, have that conversation. The exams were 50 points. All of your exams in this class are worth 50 points apiece. So if that helps you think about how to prepare, 50 points. They are available in Canvas. If you have not taken an online exam for a class, or maybe mine's a little different, I'm not sure. You can easily find the exams if you click on the quizzes folder in the sidebar on Canvas. Do keep in mind, however, that if you go there now, you might not see it. I set my availability to be just when the exam can be taken. And so right now, if you go there, you won't see an exam. But starting on September 21st, this Sunday, you will see an exam pop up in that quizzes sidebar on Canvas. That's where you'll find the first exam. It covers chapters 1, 2, and 3 of the textbook. As I'll tell you in a second, some specific parts of each of those chapters. And so here in a moment, I'm just going to provide you with some insight on what you might look for in each of those chapters. The exam is set to open next Sunday, I believe at the end of the day, Sunday on September 21st, and remain open until September 27th. So I essentially give you the entire week to take the exam. I try to do that because I know some of you work during the week and want to take it on a weekend. Others of you don't want to take it on a weekend and want to take it during the week. So I leave it open for quite a bit of time to give you a chance to take it. It is one of those exams where you're going to get one attempt, so you can't take it multiple times across one sitting. So you can't just do 5 questions and come back and do the rest later. It has to be all at once. And you are given a time limit of 40 minutes. With the number of questions, it's been a relatively good time frame. I haven't had any students indicate that that's been horribly problematic. That number may readjust depending on some fine tuning I'm doing with some of the more open-ended kinds of analytical questions. But at this point, 40 minutes, give or take. If you see when you start the exam, there will be like an introductory screen for the exam before you hit the start button. It will tell you the exact amount of time that you're allotted. And in fact, I think there might also be like a countdown bar with time. Nonetheless, think of about 40 minutes of time that you'll need to carve away to take this particular exam. The exam this time around is 22 multiple choice and true false questions. Each of those questions are worth 2 points apiece. So there's 44 of your 50 points. And then one short answer question that's worth 6 points. And that will be broken into parts. And so it's not just like one prompt worth 6 points, but some pieces worth shorter points than 6. So mostly multiple choice and true false questions, but also a short answer question too. Now I don't explicitly say this, but I'm also not oblivious to the world of online teaching. Some faculty members require you to use this system called Respondus Lockdown Browser, which means that when you're taking your exam, you're not supposed to have any other tabs or items open on your screen. It restricts you from doing that. Now, I've been on a campus committee for the last few years talking about online learning, and we understand very clearly that there are a million ways around Respondus Lockdown Browser. I'm not here to tell you all the ways you can cheat, but I also know you have phones and other computers and books around you. Like, come on, I'm not oblivious to that. So I can't say this isn't an open note, open book test. All that I can do is try to create some questions that are analytical minded so that I can really understand that you don't just get definitions, but how to apply them. The short answer question is really meant to be a question in that light. And also the time limit, it would be difficult to look up answers to every single question online or in your textbook and still make the time limit. And so that's really one way that I try to sort of deter you just from looking up everything for the test. But in normal sense, it is kind of an open book, open note test, because I can't be there telling you what you can and can't use as you're taking the exam. So let me get to some more nuance and then I'll see what questions you have. Often I get a question from students with this first exam in mind, because you haven't taken one of my exams before. I'm like, how do I prepare? What and how should I study for the exam? Chapter one, I'll tell you, is mostly definitions from the textbook and the lecture. So if you're looking at chapter one, you're going to notice it's a big review of some basic vocabulary from Intro to Community Health. And most of the questions you're going to see from chapter one are going to be very definitional, like very basic defining something from textbook or lecture. The only more complex question you might see from chapter one is being able to apply the characteristics that we talked about of professions and discuss what you know so far about health education as a discipline. That was a conversation from your book, and also we spent some time in our chapter one live lecture talking about what it means to engage in health education and sort of what it means to be a professional in a profession. So you'd want to be familiar with that. Chapter two, I'm going to tell you there are no questions on my mini history or my mini lecture on history. I remember I might have said last week that I diverted from the book a little bit to give you some context, because the book isn't phenomenal at their discussion of history. But because it's not also in the book, I don't feel comfortable testing you on it. So there are no questions from my history mini lecture. The focus of chapter two questions are going to come from the textbook reading and the lecture portion on healthy people. So you may see some questions about the healthy people objectives. Those come from chapter two. And then chapter three, as we'll discuss today, some definition questions, but largely application questions, focusing on each of the philosophies that we'll discuss today and then identifying what that philosophy would look like in practice. So the majority of questions from chapter three are going to describe how a health education professional might practice their work and then ask you to identify which philosophy they're approaching that work from. And so I would really think critically for chapter three about application in your preparation for the exam. Not so much can you define the philosophy, but could you apply it if you saw it in practice? And hopefully you'll have a good sense of that by the end of class today. I think that's it. Well, hold on. I can't remember. Yeah, I think that's it in terms of my what and how should I study conversation. But I don't want to move forward unless I address any questions you guys have as you're getting ready for next week's test. Do you have anything else that you might need my help with? Nothing. So here's the deal. You probably don't, because I highly doubt many of you have started preparing for your test next week. I get life. I know how it works. But you will as you get closer to next week and you're getting ready to sit down and actually take the exam. Please let me know how I can help. If you hit a concept or an idea from the textbook or lecture and you still are struggling to wrap your head around it, if you are looking for a vocab word that we might have talked about in lecture you can't find in the textbook, just reach out by email and I'm absolutely happy to help as you get ready to prepare for next week's exam. And I wish you all the very best of luck with that too. I always recap my exams. So after the end of next week, not next week, well, you don't have live lecture next week, reminder, because we have an exam that week. But when we come back for our next live lecture 2 weeks from now, I will recap the exam and let you know how students performed and what questions were problematic, or hopefully how successful you all were in completing the exam. So with that being said, let's move forward with the time we have left today and talk about chapter three and philosophies of health education. Like I said, philosophy isn't commonly like one of those really exciting topics that students are just thrilled to sit down and discuss, ultimately because it's complex. And I think in secondary education and higher education, we take the concept of philosophy and we add way much more complexity to a relatively simple idea than what we need to, and it scares students away. My goal today is to perhaps simplify it a little bit, but also establish how much of your personal philosophy impacts everything you do every single day. And I'll talk to you about that as we begin our conversation. I absolutely adore the television show Parks and Recreation. It's a show that I watched and it was live and on TV on NBC for many years. And I think I've made my way cycled through the television series probably 3 or 4 times on Netflix. It's like my nightly drama before I go to bed, watch an episode. You all may have shows that are like that for you, but that's my absolute favorite show. Parks and Rec, there's a character, for those of you who don't know, his name is Ron Swanson. Ron Swanson's one of the directors of the Parks and Recreation Department in a small city called Pawnee, Indiana, which is fictional. And Ron Swanson is an interesting character because he has a very distinct and I perceive unique perspective on life that is kind of strict and narrow, but humorous. And there's just things and quips that he says on the show that I find myself going, wow, that's exactly how I feel about life. So when I come to think about philosophical, I guess, perspectives and ideas that connect to how I view things, I often think of Ron Swanson. Ron Swanson says, give a man a fish and feed him for a day. Don't teach a man to fish and feed yourself. He's a grown man and fishing's not that hard, right? I think there's that old philosophical principle that if you give a man a fish, doesn't give him much, teach a man to fish, it feeds him for a lifetime. But come on, most people can figure things out on their own. Or Ron Swanson who says, cursing, there's only one bad word and that's taxes. I guess that sort of draws you into a little bit of my political perspective too, but I know you all have unique philosophical principles and ethical ideas that probably drive your interactions almost every single day. Some of them are named and you probably know that that's a philosophical idea you comply with. Others of you may have never really been called upon to think about your own personal philosophy and how that impacts what you do every day. Just trying to think of another few examples to kind of draw your thinking into this topic. And it made me chuckle a little bit this past weekend. My son, Gabe, who's 9, has a few buddies in the neighborhood and they, you know, play and ride bikes and do things young boys do. And he was getting ready to walk outside, try his bike over to Logan's house and he had no shoes on. And I said, Gabe, come on. Like, you got to put shoes on if you're going to ride your bike over to Logan's house. And my 9-year-old son, have you, turned around to me and looked at me very serious and said, Mom, YOLO. Those of you who don't know the expression YOLO, poor Gabe Jones, I don't think, understood the expression YOLO. I kind of stood and looked at him for a second, like, what did you just say to me, 9-year-old? I asked him if he knew what those letters stood for, and he said, no, but everybody says it at school, Mom, so YOLO. I said, go put your shoes on before you go to Logan's house. If you don't know what those letters mean, it's you only live once. Gabe had no idea what it meant, but it was something cool to say that his friends told him he should say in that kind of moment. But I think there are some people who live their lives under that premise. You only live once, so if there's something interesting and exciting to do, you go do it, right? That's sort of a philosophical principle in how you engage with the world around you. Do you guys have any other ideas of philosophical principles, things that you've heard of that sort of drive your interactions every day? You can unmute yourself. You can stick it in the chat if you want. You know, I had a good friend tell me that you can judge people's philosophical principles by the signs that they hang around their house. For those of you who go to like craft bazaars or hang out at places like Hobby Lobby, like I do, you'll walk around the aisles and there are these signs with quotes on them, like live, laugh, love, you know, those weird phrases that people want to put on a sign and hang up all around their house. I don't think most people give much thought to what those signs mean, but perhaps that could be conceived as a philosophical principle. I had a student once tell me that that's how they approached their life. And I thought, well, that works. What does it mean to be an ethical person? Maybe that's a more directed question that I can get some insight. If you look at someone and you say, wow, that person is really ethical and morally grounded, what is that person doing? What kinds of behaviors are they exhibiting? Come on, I know y'all are alive out there.
I'm alive. I feel like I notice somebody's ethical position when, no matter what their position is, if they're drawing a boundary or just noticeably having a different response to a situation.
Yeah. People who know their boundaries, right, are people who maybe are acting pretty ethically and they're not trying to extend beyond what they know or take into a situation. That's good. Good. What else? What does it mean to be ethical? Or at least abiding by some sort of philosophical principle to your life? Because I bet y'all do it. Oh, y'all are so quiet this morning. Am I going to need to have you unmute so I can see that you're there? Good. What is it? You say they make right decisions, yeah? And you kind of feel what rightness feels like. I know that's not the best use of language there, but if someone's engaging in some sort of act with someone else and you feel like they've done it in the right kind of way, then that might indicate that they've done it in an ethical way.
Yeah. I feel like just in general, if you can tell that someone is thinking about what they're doing before they do it, then that's a sign, because a lot of people don't really think through what they say or do first.
Yeah, it's like not spontaneously just doing things without giving some consideration to your actions beforehand, right? Yeah, that's generally an ethical person. I encourage you to think of even some very basic assumptions too, right? Like most of you know what it means to be honest, to act justly to other people. I mean, most of you would engage in the world around you without lying all the time, and that would make you a more ethical person than someone who lied about everything. And so some of these concepts of philosophical principles and ethics, I think, are easier and probably come to mind in a more explicit way when you try to attach them to behaviors people engage in. And I'll give you an example of that in a second, right? So really, when we think about sort of ancient principles and probably what you've been taught about philosophy that may make you a little bit scared of what the term means, probably come from ancient Greek and ancient Roman thinking and some of our standard historical philosophers, people like Plato or Aristotle or Socrates, who of course were engaging in a lot of philosophical thought and historical sort of merit. The term philosophy actually literally means the love of learning and the love of wisdom. So I have some students, and you know, I do some counseling at high school students from time to time, and they say, PhD, what does that mean? And I say, well, I have my doctor in philosophy. They say, you don't have a doctor in education, you're a professor. Doesn't that mean that you have a degree in education? And no, it's not. My degree is in learning and wisdom of health education and promotion, or health communication, right? Like the philosophy element of being at the top of your educational expertise comes from that principle that you love learning and thinking and being wise in some sort of subject matter. That's really what the philosophical ideal comes from, especially in some of these philosophical principles of these older individuals like Plato and Aristotle. So these are people who thought a lot about what it means to know and learn and be wise. And really, that's why many of our foundational principles when it comes to philosophy are connected to how do we know what we know? That's a term we call epistemology, right? Like, how do I really know that things are the way that they are? But it comes from that ancient perspective, right? Your textbook defines, oh so beautifully, philosophy is a statement that summarizes attitudes, principles, beliefs, values, concepts that are held by an individual or a group of people sometimes, right? And we'll talk about that group when we discuss health education here in just a minute. But all of the attitudes and the principles and the worldview and the values that really make you who you are encompassed by your personal philosophy. Now, they call it a statement. I don't think any of us could write one sentence to describe all of those things about who we are. But if you could conceptualize all of the attitudes and values and perspectives that make you unique in your perspective of the world around you, then that probably encompasses your own personal philosophy. All of us have them. They form our reality. We are all the time, every single day, walking around, engaging in behaviors, judging other people based upon that principle we have in the back of our mind of what's good and bad, what's right and wrong. We're engaging in behavior based upon our own worldview of what's good and bad and ethical and unethical. I mean, really, they make you who you are. When you think of people in the world around you and how you define those people, you probably are in some respect considering elements of their own personal philosophies. But as I mentioned to you, in my perspective, I think it's much, much easier to spot a really bad philosophical worldview than a really good one. And an example I give of this, if you don't know who this individual is on the screen, seeing his picture still makes my skin crawl. His name's Martin Shkreli. He is a CEO of a company that a few years ago, pharmaceutical company, a few years ago got a lot of attention because he just randomly sort of out of nowhere decided that he wanted to be really greedy. And he held a proprietary rights on an HIV and AIDS medication, sort of helping those individuals as they're coping with the symptoms of HIV and AIDS. And he decided sort of out of nowhere to jump the price of that particular medication because he held a monopoly over it from his particular company. 5,000%. So for people who are already battling a unique, highly sensitive, highly impactful sort of illness, and all of a sudden to have a medication that you may need to live your life positively jump by 5,000%, that's pretty sickening that someone would do that for their own personal gain and profit. He actually also defrauded some investors and ended up going to jail for some time. So, but I can look at this person and think, wow, that's a pretty unethical person to do something like that to people who are in need. It's easy for me to look at people around me who are pretty unethical, people who don't have a good philosophy or worldview, and make that judgment. But I encourage you to also look for people who do it well. People who have good and positive worldviews are also important to attend to and hopefully reach to be closer to what those individuals perceive as important ourselves, right? To act more like that and less like people like this guy for sure. Some example philosophies that are discussed in your textbook. So I know I asked you that question, and I'm going to assume that your lack of responsiveness might also have been connected to not really understanding what I was looking for, right? But as I discuss some of these example philosophies, think about how much of your life you live with an appreciation for these ideas, right? And these come from sufferance thinking. People who engage in the world around them with an appreciation that everybody else is unique and individual, and we all bring unique talents and skills and characteristics to the table every time we engage. We're all different, right? Or people who hold ethnic and cultural diversity at an utmost level of respect. Sort of that idea that we all come from unique cultural backgrounds, and how we appreciate the world may be very different from one another, but we can respect and engage in interactions appropriately because we understand that that's something they bring to the table and that's respected. As sort of as we talked about a few weeks ago in chapter one, this protection for individual or group autonomy or free choice. Individuals who engage in actions that say that I am not going to put my worldview on you because you have the choice. When I think of Ron Swanson, sometimes I think of this third perspective, right? He hates government interference in literally anything. And so he very much appreciates the idea of free choice, that the more you can remove government interference from everyday interactions and let people make choices for themselves, the better off people will be. Or the idea that if, and this is more directed towards perhaps clinical practice or health practice, that when you're creating interventions, they should be based on good science versus people who say they should be based on real world practice. We'll get later in the semester to discuss some of the interesting controversies in health education. And this is one that's a common discussion. People who have been practicing in the field for a long time who say, I don't really care that much about good science. I know what it means to do this in the real world, so I'm going to do it my way. Versus people who say, well, maybe your way isn't backed by good science and we should use that instead. Or the value of the good of one versus the value of the good of the whole. Man, this is a really interesting philosophical principle, right? Is it appropriate to encourage one person to do something that might be detrimental to themselves if it ends up helping everybody else? I think of all of those sort of cheesy, suspenseful movies that you might watch on TV, or movies themselves, I should say, where one person sacrifices themselves to save the entire community or the entire school or all of their friends. And that's, in that case, playing upon that principle that we understand sometimes you might sacrifice yourself to help the whole, right? But there are other individuals who say that one person should have mattered too. And so that's a differing ethical perspective on life. Now, what I'm going to encourage you to do as much as we can this semester is to take this kind of broad thinking and ultimately think about how these kinds of principles might surface in different kinds of health education and promotion practice and behaviors. So how might someone who's a health educator value an appreciation of just one person versus giving up that one person's autonomy to help the entire community's health, right? Or someone who might practice with a perspective that I don't tell you what to do about your health. I don't tell you to stop smoking. I give you information, and then ultimately that's your own free will and free choice. So we're going to be continually asking ourselves to reflect upon these philosophies and how they impact practice really throughout the semester, right? I did get a chat that wanted me to pop back to a slide, so I'm going to go back really, really quickly just so you can sort of get a sense of what might have been missed. Although I think if it comes, of course, my PowerPoint's super laggy. I don't know. I think if it comes from the slide that was defining philosophy, it's the love of learning and the love of wisdom, if that's what you were asking about. Philosophy entails love of learning and love of wisdom. I think I might have hit what you were looking for. If not, send me a chat and I'll send it to you in an email, okay? So, example philosophies, how do they impact health education and promotion practice? Okay. So where do our philosophies come from, I think is another interesting question, and one that I think is useful to sort of, useful to evaluate in terms of change in philosophy. Where does your philosophy come from? I think for some of us, our perspective is highly grounded in the last bullet point here. Relatives and friends, but I think for many, we start our perspective on the world from our parents. And we're taught at a very young age how to view good and bad, right and wrong. And much of that teaching comes from our parents, or at least our caregivers, the people around us, who are dictating what's good and bad to do. I try to teach my son every time somebody gives him something to say thank you, because I want him, if nothing else in the world, to have a good sense of politeness and manners. And that's a perspective as a parent that I'm trying to impart upon him, and I hope he takes into his life. Also, your relatives and your friends, right? It's just normal that the social environment you put yourself in will help dictate the kind of perspective you take on the world around you. But I think throughout time, there are other things that come to impact your philosophy that cause some change at certain points, right? Experience that you engage in. I had a student one tell me that they had a very distinct perspective on the world around them and what diversity looked like until they went on a study abroad trip. And that study abroad trip, when they saw where other people in the world are situated and how they were living, really changed their philosophical principle on life entirely. So in some case, experience is what ultimately comes to develop the sense of the philosophical principles you take into your life today. Education and study, I think the more we understand and know about what's happening in the world around us, the more we change our perspective too. And that might come from experience, or that might simply come from studying and learning different things you didn't know before. Or guidance that might not come from parents or your close social circle, but other people like your teachers or religious leaders or your mentors. Again, I think sometimes it's easy to recall instances of individuals with poor intentions leading to poor philosophical worldviews. Thinking of religious leaders and the development of things like cults, changing your philosophical principles because one person tells you to do that. But in a more positive way, you may find a very positive religious leader who helps you rethink how you view the world based upon a particular religious worldview. So all of these individuals help us develop the perspective we take into the world today. Interestingly though, at least I think, interestingly, for myself especially, some considerations to keep in mind. Your philosophy will change so many times. I can't really sit today and see any part in some respect of the way I view the world as the same as what it was when I was a kid. A lot of my philosophical principles have changed, and really it's kind of inevitable. If our philosophy is impacted by the people around us, then as our social environments change, our philosophies are going to change. As our education changes, as we learn more, as we experience more of the world, then our grounded philosophical principles are highly likely to change throughout time. Some of you might be able to reflect upon a time when you feel like your worldview or your own personal philosophy has changed based upon something you've seen or you've learned or something that you heard or engaged in with a mentor, etc. You know, my own personal example, and this is just to sort of get you thinking about your own lives. You know, I think one of the most dramatic ways in which my philosophy changed was during my senior year of my undergrad. So I come from a relatively middle-class background. Neither of my parents graduated high school. So my dad quit to work in the farms when he was a sophomore, and my mom dropped out when she was a freshman. She went back to get her GED, and my dad never went back to school. My parents highly value hard work, and they highly value education, largely because they feel like they shortchanged themselves a little bit in the decisions that they made, though. But I don't come from a background that's necessarily one that is of a bunch of professors in my line of being a professor. It's very different. Now, I've always appreciated hard work and an understanding of what it means to be low resource. I spent times in food pantry lines when I was a kid. I remember what my life was like back then. But I eventually, during the course of my undergraduate studies, I was able to take a class my senior year. It was a public relations class, strangely, which really doesn't have anything to do with the topic. And we worked with the county health department, designing a type 2 diabetes prevention campaign for Hispanic children. And I was in the group because I could speak Spanish at the time. I was taking Spanish during my high school years and as an undergrad. And after my work in that class project, I was, through that relationship, asked by the county health department to stay on board if I wanted to, and help them in their work in translating. And much of that work was in recrafting all of their written materials into different languages, particularly Spanish in that community. And so I spent an entire summer crazy boring. Pulling off every brochure, pamphlet, FAQ page, flyer, brochure off of the shelves of the health department and translating them into Spanish. Everything they had created themselves, they wanted in Spanish language. And so I was working on that project. And I found myself in the context of that project getting so frustrated by the fact that there were so many of these pamphlets and flyers and brochures that had pictures of individuals who were not Hispanic, that had cultural precepts in them that were much more Caucasian and individualistic, which is nothing like what Hispanic culture is like in some respect. And all I had to do was just take how you'd say it in English and put it into Spanish, and magically it was going to work and so fit for the Hispanic American population. And I got really upset, made my stomach upset in the work that I was doing to not value the cultural beliefs and worldviews of the individuals of that particular culture in my health education, you know, training. And so from that point on, really, I invested my graduate level study to thinking about how culture and personal characteristics impact how you receive health communication. So how does the income that you make impact what you're told about nutrition is really where I'm at now. Back then, there was some cultural race and ethnicity elements to that too. But it really changed my perspective on the world. It's likely the case that you may be able to identify similar experiences that have led you to change your personal philosophical principles. We also know that our philosophy isn't consistent in every setting, right? I encourage you to think about times where your own personal philosophy could interfere with your work as a health educator. Like, for instance, and this is just one example, right? You may personally, yourself, believe that it is never ethical to lie. I'm an honest person. I don't tell a lie. And in your personal life, you comply with that principle in pretty much everything that you do. But put yourself into the role of a health educator. We'll talk about an example, a case study of this in a few weeks, where some individual has shared information with you about their private health condition, and you need to provide some sort of counseling to that in person or provide some sort of information to others about what's going on with that person. It compromises this principle of never lying, right? What if that lie is protecting information about someone's health that they told to you in private? So we'll talk about a case of a high school sexual health educator who's trying to counsel a student about abortion decisions. And that information is given from the student to the counselor in pure and complete confidence. And you assure that student that you'll keep that information private, but is it your principle and your professional livelihood to perhaps break that philosophical perspective and lie to protect the health of that student in a way that complies with your professional ethics? So we'll discuss some times in which I think our personal ethics interfere with our professional obligations in the field of health and in the field of medicine as well. So with that being said, the rest of our conversation today is sort of going to be grouped into two areas. I want to introduce to you some philosophies that we often associate with perspectives on health overall. These aren't connected to health education, really, inherently, but rather, when we think about our health or the health of people around us, what philosophical perspectives or worldviews might drive how we think about the idea of health? Then the second chunk is going to be focused on philosophies that are unique to health education. If you're trying to provide education or counseling to a patient, what are some philosophical principles that might drive how you engage in communication with that person? But to start off, I want to think about philosophies associated with health more broadly. Now, your book discusses a few more than what I'm going to discuss here. I encourage you to focus your studying efforts for exam one on the philosophies that I'm discussing during lecture today, because ultimately I feel like there's some overlap if you start to compare them with the ones in the book. So as you're preparing, focus on these philosophies in preparation for exam one. The first, and I feel like the most basic, is what we call the philosophy of symmetry. Ultimately, this philosophical perspective tells us that there are different dimensions to health, and they are unique from one another. And each of those dimensions of health has equal importance. Now, we know some people, practitioners, clinicians, perceive that one of these might have a lot more importance than the other. You can't have a mental and spiritual health if you don't have a physical health. So I think that physical health is more important than anything else. But someone from a symmetrical philosophy would say that there are different parts, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, and they're all equally important. So just as much as I might counsel you on your physical health, I also need to talk to you about your mental health or your social health or your spiritual health. Okay? So if I'm a health educator, I'm working consistently, if I comply with this philosophy, to seek a balance between all of these different components of health. I understand that they're different from one another, but I think they should be equally considered. Now, of course, if you think in terms of ancient Chinese philosophy, the yin and the yang perspective is very much a good example of this symmetrical philosophy, right? Like, to everything, there is an equal counterpart. To night, there is day. To dark, there is light. To cold, there is warm. And someone from a symmetrical perspective almost complies directly with this kind of thinking. That to everything, there is an equal part that is different from it, but both are equally important in different contexts. So that's the symmetrical philosophy. Now, one step further, but quite a bit different, is what we have come to call the holistic philosophy. Right? Holistic philosophy says that these things are not different. So I don't care about equality. I can't talk about equality because there are no two things to talk about. The idea that the mind and the body are different from one another, or the idea that there's a mind and a body and a spirit and they're equally important, we can't even think about it because you can't separate them from one another. They're all one and the same. It's like holistic. And so the focus of someone who's appreciating this philosophy is to think about how of these different parts work together to frame this whole body perspective, right? You might think about holistic philosophy as sort of this big picture approach. I'm never going to focus on one specific micro-level problem with any patient. Rather, I'm looking at the big picture of all of the things in your life that come to form the holistic version of who you are in that moment. If you have, for instance, pain, and you're at the doctor complaining of chronic pain, what else is going on in your spiritual world, in your psychological well-being, in your social world that might come to impact that experience in a bigger picture approach rather than exactly what the physical body in that moment is experiencing? So to keep in mind, trying to differentiate the two, symmetrical says they're equal, but they're different. And holistic says there's no difference. It's all one and the same, mind, body, spirit, all the same thing. Now, one step further from the holistic philosophy is something we also call the wellness philosophy. And students sometimes have difficulty differentiating holistic philosophy from wellness philosophy. So this semester, I'm taking a little bit of a different approach and trying to explain the two. When we talk about the wellness philosophy, we're looking at a whole healthy person, which seems very similar to the holistic philosophy. And in that way, they are quite one and the same. We're not looking at different parts of you, but rather the health of the system as everything is coming to work together. The sense of optimal wellness in the context of the wellness philosophy says that we should be seeking all dimensions of our health to be at the highest level. And so whatever we can do to recognize that all of the systems are working together at optimal functioning will entail you being the healthiest person that you can be. Now, again, I don't think that feels very different than the holistic philosophy, right? All of these different parts that are really one and the same, high level, good health. What I want you to keep in mind for the wellness philosophy, when somebody says that they're appreciating a philosophy to health that's focused on wellness, in current conversation, they're complying with this philosophical approach that's advocated by this group of scholars out of the University of Wisconsin, who have told us that wellness is defined by 7 primary dimensions. And the whole person is well when all of these dimensions are working together to craft a healthy person who's living at the optimal level. Those 7 dimensions include your intellectual health. We haven't heard that mentioned yet, right? Your occupational health, what's going on with your job, your emotional health, your spiritual health, things that are going on in your environment, your physical health, which we discuss a lot, and your social health. So someone who says, I appreciate wellness, is likely saying, I'm attending to health from the perspective of all of these dimensions, working at their optimal level to keep you as healthy as you could possibly be. So symmetrical perspective is quite different from holistic and wellness in that it's differentiating unique parts of you that are working together, but are unique and different from one another. The holistic philosophy says it can't be unique. They're all one and the same. They're working together all the time. And wellness is saying something very similar to that, but it's focusing on these 7 primary dimensions of wellness and how they're functioning to ensure that you are at an optimal level of health and well-being. Now, there are others that are discussed in your textbook, but these are the 3 that I want you to keep in mind because you'll see them surfacing in some of the case studies we'll read later in the semester, more so than some of the others discussed in your textbook. Now, I'm not going to ask you in the context of the exam many application questions about these previous three philosophies. I'd be prepared to know their differences based upon definition, more so than application, just because it's difficult, in my opinion, to sometimes differentiate between holism and wellness. And so I'm not going to ask you to go to that sort of level of complexity for exam one. Where I am going to ask you to do a lot of application thinking is within our prominent health education philosophies, because they are very different from one another and you can see them operating different in practice very clearly. Okay? I encourage you as I'm walking through these five philosophical approaches to think about which of these you think is most correct. I would imagine, especially if you're connected to the medical field or even human psychology or social work that is involving people, you probably take a perspective on health behavior that's more in line with one of these philosophies than the others. Okay. The first that I want to discuss is the philosophy that we call the behavior change philosophy. To be quite honest, I feel like this is the old school traditional way of engaging in health education. This is like the most common traditional perspective. Okay? Behavioral contracts, goal setting, self-monitoring are all kinds of behaviors that you might engage in as a health educator to get your patient to change what they're doing relative to their health. So if you believe in the behavior change philosophy, you believe that people are going to engage in behavior change that is measurable with outcomes that you can easily set. And so all of your assessment and understanding of your engaging in health education is based upon people changing behaviors, outward things you can see. And so how do you get people to change their behaviors? Well, maybe they read a contract that says that by the end of next month, I'm going to commit to sleeping more than 8 hours a night for 3 nights a week, right? They set a goal for themselves that across the next month, that's something they're going to engage in. And then throughout that next month, they're monitoring their behaviors to see if they're complying with the goals that they've set. At the end of that month, you can measure their outcomes. They're easy to evaluate. And you can ultimately make assumptions on whether or not they've changed their behavior based upon what they're doing to meet those objectives that they've set for themselves, right? The outcomes are easy to see because it's pure behavior change. So an example of someone who appreciates this kind of philosophy to their practice might be encouraging their clients to set behavioral contracts and goals. Maybe that's increasing the number of study hours they engage in per week or how many days they go out drinking with friends and asking their patients to monitor themselves with those goals in mind to engage in change and be motivated. So that's our behavior change philosophy, philosophy number one. Philosophy number two is what we call the cognitive-based philosophy, and it's changing our perspective from outward behavior to instead thoughts and thinking and attitudes and really something more focused on actual information as it comes to impact changes. So the focus of this perspective instead of actual behavior is on the importance of gaining content and factual information. Like what content and facts do you need to encourage behavior change? Someone who believes in this perspective really heavily encourages the idea that if you give people enough knowledge, they'll make better decisions. So if I give you tons and tons and tons of pieces of information and facts and what happens when you take this pill and what happens when you engage in this preventative behavior and here's the evidence and the research and the information, you'll engage in change. It's not so much setting contracts and goals for yourself to change your behavior. It's more so, let's give them lots of information and see what happens. So for example, if you're in the world of a health campaign and you're posting statistics about death and injuries if you don't wear your seatbelt, your assumption is that all the information about all those statistics, all that knowledge is going to change someone's behavior. Also, you know, some people really comply. I think medical field complies with information in this kind of form. My mom's been going through cancer treatment, and every single time she goes to an appointment, she gets another like brochure of what to expect with this kind of medication. And it's just sort of handed to her. Here's all the information you need to engage in sort of coping with this treatment modality. So someone who's focused on pure information is likely someone who's approaching health education from a cognitive-based philosophy. The more you know, the better off things will be. The third philosophy is called the decision-making philosophy, and I sort of think of this, to me, as the Ron Swanson philosophy from Parks and Rec. Do what you can to help people, understand the situations that they're in, and then encourage them to make their own decisions on their own accord. By, in many cases, helping them to conceptualize what it would look like to actually live in that particular perspective. So the more you can ask individuals to simulate problems that they may face and then how to cope with those problems, or create fictional scenarios, like what if this happened to you, what would you do? Or maybe read case studies of individuals who've done something specific and then changed our behavior based upon the case study. You're likely saying, I'm giving you as much reality as I can to understand what things could be. Now you go about making the decision on your own behalf. A lot of people who use this philosophy are very highly focused on critical thinking. So if I can get my patient to think critically about a case of someone similar or a scenario that they could be engaged in, then they'll make a change to their behavior that's going to last for a lifetime. One of my favorite examples of this, I don't know, for those of you who are interested in nutrition education, but I don't know many diets where there isn't some sort of message of, look at Jenny who used this diet plan and lost 50 pounds. Look at this person who used the Atkins diet, right? Show us your hashtag Atkins success. Is asking people to compare themselves to those who've engaged in the behavior and then make decisions on their own behalf based upon what they see of other success. This is a pure example of the decision-making philosophy. Think of yourself in that, think of yourself engaging in that behavior, and then ultimately engage in it because you have the free will to do so yourself. Okay? Philosophy number four is called the freeing or functioning philosophy, and this one's very different than the previous three, so it won't be hard to differentiate. This philosophy was actually crafted as like this massive counter reaction to all these traditional approaches. It seemed to put all of the blame for bad choices on people and not their situations or their environments, right? Like if I give you a case study about how to do something different of someone else who engaged in exercise 3 days a week and lost 50 pounds, right? And you don't make that choice in your free will, it's your fault. If I give you all the statistics in the world and the health information, and you don't change, that's your fault. If I ask you to set a behavioral contract and monitor your behavior and then it fails, that's your own fault. There's an approach that says we shouldn't be blaming people themselves so much. We should look at other things like the situation and environments that they're a part of, right? So the freeing idea is like freeing people to make their own decisions based upon their own needs and their own interests and who they are, and not necessarily any needs of society or the health educator. So it's similar to the last perspective, and then it's saying, make your own decisions. But really this perspective is best for people who can make good decisions on their own. If people are in a situation where they can't make reasonable decisions on their own behalf, then I don't necessarily know this is a very good approach to take, right? And otherwise, when you make your own decisions, it makes you feel like you've made more ownership over your choices, which can make this more impactful if people can make the right kind of choice. So if you're trying to think about what this philosophy means, you know, think of the oh so common quotes like, do what's best for you in your life and not what's best for other people, or keep calm and stop caring. That's really what someone who appreciates this philosophy would engage in their practice, right? You do what's best for you, care little about anybody else, and I'm going to tell you about how to do what's best for you in my counseling of you. The last approach, again, is quite different than the others. I think this is the approach that I take. So this is where I'm situated as a health educator, and that's the social change philosophy. It's our argument in this philosophy that health education shouldn't be about individual counseling. It should be about creating social environments, economic and political environments that benefit an individual's health, that probably do very little in terms of actual one-on-one counseling for health behavior change, right? To see this in action would be someone who's focused on laws and policy making that's really meant to enhance everybody's health, not just the health of one particular person. And so policies like don't smoke in restaurants, wear your mask in public, new housing development where we ask for sidewalks to be put in so people can exercise. A health educator who's trying to work on policy to help a broader group of people is likely focused more so on a social change philosophy. We don't worry so much about people as we do creating good environments so that when people are engaging in changes, they've got a space to support the kind of changes that they're making. Okay. So those are the five health education philosophies that I want you to be able to understand and apply for the purpose of the exam. You might see questions that describe a scenario of something a health educator is doing in practice and then ask you to say, yes, that's social change in action, or yes, that's freeing functioning in action. I do my best to make it pretty explicit and clear, but you'll want to feel comfortable with the differences across these five as you sit down to take the exam. So I encourage you, an old assignment we used to have students engage in this class would be to create your own philosophy. Considering questions like, what does it mean for you to be healthy? What are your own health responsibilities and obligations to yourself, to community, to other people? Do you brush your teeth every day? Do you wear a mask in public? Like, what is it that makes health to you? What do you expect your community and society to do to keep you healthy? Now, you might not think these questions are that important, but I've sat in twice now as a reviewer in a employment, an interviewer, a group interview, of someone who was interviewing to become a campus health educator in Wisconsin and here at Ball State. And individuals in their interviews were asked these questions, and we were able to judge their receptivity and ability to be a campus health educator based upon how clearly they had defined their own understanding of health and their own personal and community obligations relative to being a healthy person. So you might think about how you'd answer these questions, because if you're going to work in the field of health ed, you might be asked them in a job interview. Otherwise, for this class in particular, I want you to continue to consider, what is this field? What does it mean to be a professional? What are your goals for yourself and your profession? And then how are those fitting in with your own responsibilities to yourself, your community, and to just the profession itself? Again, we're going to investigate each week a little bit more about the work of health education, and I'm going to continually be asking you to think about how your philosophical principles drive your understanding of what it means to be a professional in this field. So these ideas are going to return at later points throughout the semester for sure. So my friends, it looks like I've spent about an hour in conversation. Yeah. As you're preparing for exam one next week, do let me know if you have any questions as you're studying or as you're thinking about content from lecture or your textbook. I have office hours today until about 1 o'clock. So if you go over to the other Zoom room that I put in this week's announcements, we can have a chat in office hours if you'd like more detail or explanation. I also have office hours Thursday from 10 to 11. And if those times don't work for you, you can always email me and we can set up another time to chat. So don't feel like you're constrained to just those specific times. But otherwise, if you guys don't have any questions, that's all I've got for you today. Go out and have an outstanding week 4. And I will not talk to you live and in person next week because you'll be taking your exam. But I'll see you in 2 weeks when we come back together for week 6 of the semester already. Everybody all right? Any questions? Let's see. Cool. All right, everybody, have a great week. We'll talk to you next time. Adios, amigos. See ya.